21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Lord, how is it that I could come out to hear and be still floating and never hit bottom and keep falling through, just relaxed and paying attention?
Listen to these guys just a little bit more. This is the fifth dimension. It's called the birds, you know. Here they go. Here they go. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Kortner, and our engineer is Anita Brockington. Our guest is Nicholas Pearson. We're talking about his book called Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine, published by Destiny Books, on the web at theluminouspearl.com, or find him on Facebook, Twitter, and all social media. And remember, all links are at 21stcenturyradio.com, where our archives are posted weekly for free, as well as on YouTube and on iTunes. Subscribe today and tell your friends. Are you with us, Nicholas?
I sure am.
Okay, now did you bone up on all the other questions I asked you about?
I think so.
Good. All right, so here it is. Now, for $1,500, what is your personal view of the divine? Do you believe... Let me finish.
Sure.
All right. Do you believe in a literal goddess, or do you consider yourself a polytheist?
You know, I think the official answer to what is my personal view of the divine is it's complicated.
Yep.
You know, I have so many amazing friends and colleagues who are part of that debate of hard polytheism where the gods are separate, discrete entities. And then I've got friends who are soft polytheists, and everybody makes really great arguments for it. And, you know, to take a page out of my teacher Christopher's book, I see myself kind of in between the two. I think the gods are just as discrete and separate as you and I are. But I don't think we're all that separate. I think if we're all first ideas in the heart mind of Creator, an idea never leaves its source. And so we are never separate from the divine, and therefore we're never separate from one another. And we're really just one. So I do believe in a literal goddess, but I don't necessarily think that, you know, she wears a particular dress and spoke a particular language and had only one mythic life cycle. But I think the egregore, like the group consciousness of all of the worshipers and devotees of particular god forms and goddess forms and spirits over the eons has kind of concretized in a way. It's like we've got this aggregate of belief and myth and story that we have projected onto and received from the divine simultaneously. And so they've become in their own way these kind of separate figures in the same way that we're separate figures. So yeah, it's complicated. That's the easy way.
Well, what are the facts? Facists. Sorry, let me ask this question again. What are the facets of the goddess that you describe in part two of Stones of the Goddess?
So there is sort of this ongoing discussion, we'll say, in the pagan sphere or the witchy sphere about, you know, the gods and spirits as archetypes. And I tried to avoid overusing the word archetype because it has very specific psychological connotations. But the facets of the goddess in this book are the archetypal roles, we'll say, the archetypal mythic arcs that we see in the divine feminine. So, you know, we might call them the sort of job class descriptions that we can assigned to goddesses. So, you know, we've got the Great Mother, we've got the Earth Mother, we have the Queen of Heaven, we have, you know, the Muse or the Goddess of Inspiration, we have the Goddess of Love and Sexuality and Beauty. We also have this fierce face of the goddess, she who is the warrior, she is the Dark Mother, she's the one who's going to, you know, seek retribution for her children. And, you know, at the end of the day, As wonderful and amazing as it is to kind of assign these roles to goddesses, the more we get to know any particular figure out of myth, the more we realize they can never be reduced to a short description. Mm-hmm. Just like human beings. I mean, if we use, you know, the women of today as examples for the goddess, there's no woman on the face of the earth who can be reduced to one role she plays. She is so much to so many people, and therefore so are, you know, the divine manifestations of the feminine, if our otherwise more everyday manifestations, though no less divine, are so multifaceted, then so is the goddess herself in all of her guises. So whether we're a hard polytheist or a soft polytheist, I think those facets are like windows in to entering that stream of energy a goddess offers and represents and guides, but it is not the only thing she does.
Well, the art in this book is a departure from your previous books on crystals. Could you tell us more about the visual direction you chose?
Absolutely. This was a lot of fun to photograph and a lot more labor intensive. So for anyone who has kind of leafed through my books in the past, it's been basically a rock on a plain background. And I really didn't want to do that for this. The seed that was planted at the very beginning was I had very lofty goals of trying to make every image in this book look as if it was a ritual in motion, or maybe a snapshot of some sort of sacred place. And while many of them do kind of have that feeling to them, some of them had to be a little bit more metaphorical and a little bit more subtle. And then there were a few rocks on plain backgrounds, so that way it was visually interesting. But I got to work with my fiance on this. He is my photographer and has done all the art for my books so far. But he really got to be creative. So I had to be the art director. And he got to manifest those. So some of my favorite images in any of my books are actually in this one. The strand of pearls that you see under the pearl entry belonged to my grandmother, you know, one of my own personal visions of the divine feminine. And, you know, it's this really kind of vintage, intimate photo of, you know, those pearls amidst a bunch of seashells. My birthstone is garnet, and, you know, garnet and pomegranate share a possible etymological root. It's debated.
Are you a Capricorn?
I sure am.
My God, my life is surrounded by Capricorns. What do you think that means? You think I'm kidding you? I'm not kidding you. Not only my wife is a Capricorn, and my son's a Capricorn. We have other Capricorns in our family, and we have other Capricorns that we're working in our office. It's just because you guys are probably the best organizers on the planet and some of the hardest workers on the planet and that kind of thing, and perhaps also some of the most intelligent on the planet. That's not too bad, is it? That's pretty good.
I think I could be accused of worse things. How's that?
Couldn't we all? Yeah, right. Indeed. Oh, where were we?
Yeah, we were talking about garnet. So,
oh, yeah. Oh, God, that's right.
Yeah, to really evoke the sort of mythic connection to like the descent of Persephone into the underworld. We've got this beautiful cluster of garnet crystals all hand-polished up beside this freshly cut pomegranate. And you can see the similarity in the shape of the arils and the fruit and the crystals. So I really wanted the stories, the pictures themselves to tell a story in the way that my other books hadn't. And it made it so much fun.
Yeah.
It also made it a lot of work, but it was great fun. And I'm so thankful to Stephen for exceeding my expectations on the art.
Good going, Stephen. How long you guys been together?
5.5 years this month. And we just got engaged in August.
Well, congratulations, boy.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it really makes a very big difference when you got a partner that understands and works with you, and you've got a lot to learn from him, and he's got a lot to learn from you, and it just makes life so much more exciting than what the normal thing that most people have of going to the movies and watching TV.
It really is. I mean, he's brought so much enrichment to my life, and, you know, loving rocks is contagious. So it's a horrible disease that he caught from me. And, you know, there are even stones pictured in this and some of my other books that belong to him.
Oh, so, well, yeah. Hey, what kind of stones did he throw in this book? Come on.
Let's see. You know, I'm hard pressed for a really good example off the top of my head, but he's got this beautiful lapis lazuli sphere that I think is the central stone in the image of lapis in this book. He's also got a lapis lazuli skull that's going to be pictured in my next book, but I'm getting ahead of myself. And just there's a pretty good assortment of things that came from him. The art in this book we borrowed, we'll say, props from our local occult bookstore called Avalon here in Orlando. And it was just so much fun to be able to like shop without spending money in a way. I mean, everything went back to the shelves when I was done, but it was fun to have like a whole store's worth of occult items and sacred statues and jewelry and gemstones to supplement my own goods to do this.
Yeah.
And that was part of what made the art so much fun.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and I love the cover, and it's only a measly 450-some pages, guys, so you can imagine what it's like to read one of these in a week. It's hard. But fortunately, I was given your book, as you know, months ago, so I had a good chance to read it twice, and it really makes a difference to read a book twice than just once. Okay, you ready for the next question?
I think so.
Okay, what are some examples of the newly discovered stones included in Stones of the Goddess? This is one of the big ones.
Yeah, so, you know, I mentioned earlier that I didn't want to just stick to the sort of classical stones that we see in, you know, the mythological record and, you know, the more historical sources. I wanted to have a survey of some fresh and exciting things that obviously weren't talked about by ancients in goddess worship. So some of them are maybe less weird and wonderful at first glance. You know, things like many different kinds of calcites that are in this book weren't something that our ancients really knew and used. A great example is cobaltuan calcite, which in the New Age has adopted this name of Aphrodite stone, and it has this really intense energy that is a very expressive and emotive way to connect to the sort of Venusian aspects of the Great Mother. Dioptase is one of my favorite copper-bearing minerals. Copper is getting a lot of airtime, but I really do have a love affair with copper minerals. And dioptase, I want to say, was discovered in the 1980s, first in like the Ural Mountains of Russia. And these mines were historically used for like mining things like malachite and other copper ores. But when this was discovered, they knew it was a copper mine, and the color of dioptase and natural light is the most vivid emerald green you can imagine. So they were nicknamed copper emeralds. Although they bear no relationship with emerald except for the color. And on later analysis, we figured out it's a complex copper silicate. But there's this sort of mythology of that region, of this idea of Mount Venus and the mother of the mountain. And some of these myths have kind of been bastardized over the years, and you know what once might have been a pre-Christian memory of the worship of the divine mountain, the divine feminine on the mountaintops, has kind of degraded into, you know, maybe a little more than the iconic witch or crone who is out to get you if you go down the wrong mine shaft. But it's amazing to see that even this newly discovered stone has an ancient link to this idea of Mount Venus is the sort of sabbatic place that, you know, the witches fly to on their Sabbats and, you know, worship the divine feminine. Of course, the stories we have of the witches' Sabbat are a little convoluted as they came from the church, but, you know, here we've got this beautiful green gem that sort of references them. But there are lots of great new stones, the Lemurian seed crystals, Scarlet Temple Lemurians or strawberry Lemurian seed crystals. There's a new variety called Blue Mist Lemurians, sometimes also called the Veil of Isis Lemurians, which is my favorite name for them. This is one of the first books you can read about them inside, and they're just so enigmatic, and they're just pure magic. The first time I ever saw one of these crystals, my dear friend and one of my mentors in the crystal healing world, Sharon Britton, is telling me about them, and she offers me one, and I get to, you know, pick one out sight unseen from a box, and I'm just in love with its energy. I'm like, Sharon, they're amazing, but what do they do? She goes, Nicholas, they're the invitation to the cosmic dance.
Whoa.
And I think to myself, that is so poetic, but what the heck does it mean? right? And you know, these are the stones that say, like, cosmically, on a galactic level, if Earth wants to sit at the grown-ups table next to Thanksgiving, we have to step up our game. If we really want to play with the cosmic powers that are out there, we have to start acting like we deserve it. We do deserve it. We are worthy of it, but we don't behave as if we are. And so this is one of those stones that really invites us to do the inner work and the planetary work to get our collective consciousness up to a place where we can, you know, maybe work mostly in the light, for the light, and to the benefit of all sentient beings, which is no small feat.
Well, for the benefit of everybody out there in the audience, we got to take a break. So let's all sit up straight, eyes straight ahead, and no talking, and you can chew gum. We allow that on 21st Century Radio. See, we're liberal, but to a degree, of course, with our guest, Nicholas Pearson, Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine Destiny books. If you're looking for a book to pass on to anyone in your family or friends, especially children, about stones, this is it. Stones of the Goddess. Start them off right. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
This is Ellie Flippin, niece of the late psychic, visionary, artist, and extraordinary individual, Ingo Swann. You can learn more about his archives, his paintings, and his books at ingoswann.com. You are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Oh, good, good. Ingo Swann, El Bigo. Where would we be today without Ingo Swann? Well, that's your problem, not mine. We've already talked about that for 15 years, so maybe somebody will remember. Our guest, of course, is Nicholas Pearson, Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine Destiny books. And if you think we want you to buy this book, you're right. You're absolutely right. Because this is the kind, why don't you buy a couple of these books? Two or three of these books? Because all of your friends are going to want it, no doubt about it, for what's coming up. However, are you there, Nicholas?
I think I am.
We're going to make a deal, and the deal is very simple. Anyone buys a copy of this book and can prove it, we will give them any book. We've been on the air for 30-some years, and boy, we got thousands of books, needless to say, that we want to pass on. So I think we would like to certainly share them as soon as possible to our listeners out there. But the next question is, what are some crystals you wanted to include in the Stones of the Goddess that didn't make the cut? I guess they're kind of called juniors then. They didn't make the cut.
Yeah, maybe the B-sides.
That's very good. Yes, all right.
So I think some of these I'm kind of regretful about. You know, hindsight is 20/20. One of my absolute favorite gems that I've worked with in my personal healing journey is rhodonite. I think it's a great stone for connecting to the divine feminine. Although there's no ancient lore about it, it's definitely a really wonderful stone for kind of anchoring the really tangible force of nature that is divine love, especially as expressed through that kind of nurturing quality of our cosmic mother. And then its sort of cousin or companion stone is rhodochrosite, which is a really wonderful stone of like liberation. It helps us kind of break through old patterns. And I think rhodochrosite is such an appropriate stone for the world at large and has this really sweet feminine energy that's also, you know, kind of fierce at times. I think that's a great one too. Ruby. I really kind of mourn that Ruby didn't get more than a few honorable mentions in the appendices. But, you know, Ruby's a stone that there are so many myths around it. Plus, there are so many stones that were once called Ruby. It's hard to separate, you know, the...
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's hard to separate the chemical Ruby, you know, aluminum oxide from all the other red stones that just got called it.
Well, thank you for letting us know about that. Well, I looks like I have to study under you for the next five more years or so to find this other stuff out.
I'll keep you updated.
Good. Because this is a major part of my life, and one of these days I'm going to be able to communicate with them directly. That's my goal. Okay. Because do you have any little bags that you put your stones in when you carry them around?
Sometimes, yeah. Oftentimes I'll make use of that little teeny useless watch pocket that'll be in my pants.
Oh, yes.
Safe, a stone can live there. Many times, though, if I've got one that's stable enough and not sharp and not brittle, I'll just put it straight in my pocket so that way I can reach my hand in, and I'm making that tactile connection with the stone itself. There's no barrier between us. But other times I use pouches, too.
That's a good feeling to have them in your pockets. Were there any particular goddesses or other manifestations of the divine feminine that inspired or guided your work?
There were. I would say that as I was writing the book, I really kind of connected to a lot of specific goddess forms and currents of the divine feminine as I was writing about the stones related to them. But there are a couple that I think have been really big in my personal life. And one is not a true and proper goddess in the original sense, but we often consider her one today, especially in the New Agey movement. And that is Kuan Yin, or as I call her in Japanese, Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion and mercy. And the only actual goddess statue I have in my house is of Kuan Yin, and she is in almost every room of my house. In fact, she might actually be in every room except the bathroom and the laundry room.
Whoa.
Right? I should fix that.
Well, maybe you should. You know, we have a Statue of Liberty in just about every room in our house. No joke. So there, take that.
You got me beat again.
Okay. I'm sorry, but I have so much fun with you.
I love it. But you know, this idea of compassion, of this really deep, merciful, gift that we give ourselves and therefore other sentient beings is really important to me. Kanon Bosatsu, or the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin in Japanese, is also near and dear to some of my other spiritual practices that come from the East, from traditional Japanese Reiki. We see some tenuous connections to her. And then in Japanese folk religion, which has really inspired me for quite a while now, I really have this deep relationship with her. But then also in a totally different cultural context, there's a goddess or a spirit that has her own shrine above my writing desk, and that is Yemaya, who is sort of like the supernal mother of the oceans from African traditional religion. And she's been this cosmic force that has stepped into my life on more than one occasion to help me out or save me or occasionally kick my butt as needed.
Well, you need to get that. I mean, that's important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Be kicked around.
One of my favorite images in the book is the stone Larimar, which is found in the Caribbean.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And, you know, the worship of Yemaya is very strong in the Caribbean. And her colors are blue and white, and the stone is shades of blue and white. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of took these traditional tools, the herramientas, and her eleque, or her necklace, and kind of encircled the stone with them to kind of symbolize this link between the two. And it just feels like a match made in heaven to offer Larimar to the great ocean mother.
It's so beautiful. It's just the prettiest color of blue. And it was hard to find there for quite a while. Then now it's gotten so popular, it's hard to find again. Because people are slurping it up.
Absolutely.
Were there any particular myths about crystals and the divine feminine that you found surprising?
There were actually a number that I thought were either surprising or at the very least amusing. I think a great example of this is lapis lazuli.
Again, one of
my favorites. Uh-huh. Of all the goddesses that she's related to, the most obscure is either a Sumerian or Mesopotamian goddess whose name I'm sure I'll butcher, but it's Sur or Seer. And she is, among other things, the goddess of brewing beer. And it has been suggested that maybe this alchemical act took place in her cauldron carved out of lapis, which I do not suggest. Beer brewing in a lapis cauldron isn't going to yield anything drinkable. But Because lapis is like the stone of the night sky and has this really cosmic and divine thing, it's almost kind of funny to see it connected to beer, which is transcendent and alchemical in its own right. So, you know, and if you have enough of it, the stars will spin. So maybe it's a great connection.
What beer do you recommend?
Oh, yeah, I'm not a drinker myself. So whatever your favorite is, have at it.
Well, there's only one favorite that I have, and I forget it every now and then. A Guinness. Mm. A Guinness or a stout, because as I'm sure you're aware of, there's a certain amount of benefits to the minerals within Guinness that you don't find in any other beer. And that really has, I used to hate it because just the original taste of Guinness is so bitter. But there's a lot of things. I had to do some research into that area, and I did okay. I got about a B+ in that class.
Well, very nice. And you taught me something, so we're getting even as the night goes on.
Yeah, well, what did I teach you tonight about?
Well,
the Baltimore Colts or anything? Did I teach you anything about them?
Not yet.
No, okay.
But now you taught me about beer.
Well, they now have a beer which, oh gosh, Rudy, I have a dear friend, a musician, and he can only drink. No, not Ziggy Marley never drinks. No, we're talking about another singer altogether. No, you don't remember? Okay, well, we're going to have to forget about him. My producer says we can't talk about that. Now, in the book, you discuss the connection between rock formation processes and the divine feminine. Wow, this is most unusual. Could you elaborate on that and tell us where the inspiration came from?
Yeah, so I think this was when I originally started dreaming up this connection. I say dreaming as if I was in charge of it. I don't think that was the case. But when I first started contemplating it, I thought this would be maybe a few cute paragraphs kind of connecting the formation processes of igneous rock, metamorphic rock, and sedimentary rock, respectively, to the sort of archetypal facets of maiden, mother, and crone in the triple goddess. And I really expected it to be a short little aside, and that would be it, until I started really holding pieces of these stones and meditating on how they might link us to those primal forces of the triple goddess, and started to have like real dialogue with them and see them in a very crisp and clear way. So in a way, they're like invented or found goddesses that have manifested through the mineral kingdom. And I had so much fun doing this, creating, invocations to them. I wrote in this book in my own version of The Charge of the Goddess, which is a famous piece of witchcraft liturgy, but I reframed it within the context of this triple goddess of stone. And it started by meditating with the rock itself. I think we can learn a lot about what crystals offer us if we look at how they're formed, what they're made out of, and the way those things come together. And so it starts with that formation process. So igneous rocks are newborn rock. They have the potential to be the youngest rock, and so they naturally connect us to the maiden. When other rocks are subjected to heat and or pressure, they are transformed. They mature in a way. And so that links us to, you know, the idea of the mother, the matron. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when things are subjected to that erosive nature of time itself, we have sedimentary rock, and then we can link to the crone aspect of the triple goddess. And although this idea of the triple goddess is much more modern than I think the larger community may be aware of, there's a certain amount of poetic truth in it that speaks to all of us. And so I wanted to find a way to connect to it that wasn't necessarily dependent upon, you know, the biological viability of a woman's life cycle. I wanted to look at it through the lens of rock because, you know, rock doesn't really have a gender. You know, here we have been talking about crystals of the goddess, but, you know, rocks don't check a box on their driver's license for male, female, or other. They're just rocks. So I think it's a way for us to conceive of how the divine feminine manifests in ways that don't have to be limited to the gender binary. Although the language we use is very gendered because that's what we're comfortable with, it's definitely beyond that. So I had a lot of fun with this chapter. And my goal was to teach occultists and healers alike about geology. And I think I might have succeeded.
Geology. That's very unusual, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the space that I'm in. I love kind of connecting that hard science to the metaphysical and spiritual. And
well, that's terrific. I mean, that's what we're supposed to be doing, actually,
in
my opinion. Yeah. Well, of course, I'm biased. I know you're not biased, but I am. And in this particular... look, we got to take another break here on 21st Century Radio. Rules and regulations 506 of the Penal Code indicate that we must do this right now. Stones of the Goddess with our dear friend Nicholas Pearson, Crystals for the Divine Feminine Destiny Books, and also on Facebook, Twitter, and all social media, you'll find them. See them sitting over there. And also remember that all links are at 21stcenturyradio.com.
Hello, this is Rosemary Ellen Guiley. I'm the author of the Encyclopedia of Magic and Alchemy and many other books on the paranormal. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Oh, gosh, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, what a wonderful person. Scores and scores of books that she wrote. I just loved reading them, and she was just a great guest on 21st Century Radio. But I'm sorry she's passed on to spirit. She was such an inspiration in the physical world here. And our guest, of course, is Nicholas Pearson. We're in the last segment of 21st Century Radio, Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine Destiny Books, and on the web at theluminouspearl.com. Okay, since you've written a book about the Divine Feminine, do you have any plans for a follow-up on the Divine Masculine?
I do. We'll start with that. But here's the thing. I don't know what the timeline's going to be. I have ideas for a lot of books, and I've got other projects underway. So I've started some of the preliminary research. The table of correspondences was begun around the same time I started the early notes for Stones of the Goddess. And in addition to working with the Divine Masculine, I'd love to do one on the Divine Androgyne, the sort of great divine that's beyond our ability to break it down into these polar forces. So those are high hopes. One day we'll see them. I'm just not sure when that's going to be.
Do you, when you write something like this, when you get involved with something like this, do you over a period of time just collect information or begin your writing at the same time? Or do you just leave it all alone till you got it all together?
It kind of depends on the project. But what I like to do is I like to dive in to the library, my personal books and whatever else I can get my hands on, and start finding all of the evidence to support my claims, all the little footnotes and endnotes that you see in this book, for example. And then once I have those kind of laid out, I can start to formulate where I'd like the hypotheses to lead me. And then I create a bigger outline, and that eventually turns into a book. So I try to write concurrently with research just so I can manage my time. But, sometimes the research doesn't go where you want it to, and you have to take a breather.
Mm-hmm. I do that a lot. Well, could you tell us a little bit about your upcoming book, Crystal Basics?
It would be my pleasure to do so. I am so excited for this book. This is the book that I wish had existed when I started working with crystals and when I really started looking for the correlations between mineral science and geology and crystal healing. So this is, in some ways, the culmination of my 25 years so far with stones. It has a compendium of 200 crystals. It wasn't always 200. I thought maybe 75 would be a good number, and I more than doubled it. I'm not sure how that happened. But it just kept growing.
Well, they grow by themselves.
They do. And then the first couple parts of the book are really focused more on the theory of how crystals work and then what the heck you do with them. There's so many amazing crystal books on the market. It's no secret that I love books. I've got maybe about 350 books devoted to crystals in many different contexts, both spiritual and scientific. But I rarely find a book that is both a good crystal dictionary, a list of crystal properties, as well as a how-to guide. You often get a little bit of column A with a lot of column B, or column B only with no column A whatsoever. And I wanted to provide someone who was coming into crystals either as a beginner or a long-time crystal lover with a complete all-in-one guide. So you're going to find chapters devoted to making layouts, doing the preliminary work like cleansing and programming your crystals, how to create crystal elixirs, how to meditate with your stones, like what do you do to form a relationship with them, as well as the most thorough explanation of why crystals work, how they work, and what the tangible influences are in our energy field, our psyche, as well as our body. So I did my best to summarize all of that in as few words as possible, and wouldn't you know, it's still like 416 pages.
That's the way it goes. But, you know, the aspect that I'm most interested in, when I first started to read this book, what was it, maybe half a year ago, was about what you talked about in regards to, say, for instance, the first 30 or 40 pages. I think you cited them, but for example, could you tell us about the Gaia hypothesis that you did a great job on page 4, or later maybe, if we had more time, get into quartz crystals in particular are described as brain cells of the planet, and why? I mean, the first 30 pages are all great stuff, which we didn't touch on tonight. I just wanted our listeners to know that it's there, such as how is human consciousness changing? What is entrainment? And whenever there is discord in the body, mind, or spirit, there is also disharmony represented in the energy field around us. You go through all this material with in great detail, and I appreciated that.
Thank you.
And it's because learning it from this perspective is you cover the whole field. Let me put it that way. You cover the whole thing. And you do it in such a way that I find very interesting. But let's touch on this Gaia hypothesis, because it is key. It is key to our future.
Yeah. So I would say it was the 1970s. James Lovelock kind of proposed this idea of how the Earth is a self-regulating system. And it behaves in the same way that a living organism does. So although the actual hypothesis doesn't come right out and say that the Earth is one organism and we're all cells in her body, a very poetic way to interpret it is the Earth is one superorganism and we're all cells in her body. So a lot of the same sort of homeostatic mechanisms that we might find in the human body, we find parallels of on planet Earth. And it's not just the biosphere. It's not just the biological living materials and organisms that are interacting to do this. It is all the biotic and abiotic factors that work together to produce this seemingly living superorganism that is Mother Earth. Mm-hmm. And of course, it would be appropriate that we would have this idea named after the Greek embodiment of the Earth goddess, Gaia. I mean, so much of our language relating to nature, to rocks and minerals, takes us back to this concept of the Earth is this living, breathing being who is here to birth us and to receive us. And, you know, in every day of our life, we are part of the goddess. There's no way to separate ourselves from the superorganism any more than you can separate one skin cell from you as a really separate identity. Sure, we could zoom in under a microscope and see it, but it is still you. Within the DNA in any cell of your body is the code for your whole being. And that's kind of what we're like here as cells in the body of Mother Earth. And so are all of the other cells in the body of Mother Earth. And if we kind of zoom out from that perspective, then it's humbling on one hand, because we see that we are not maybe the crown of creation that we want to be or want to perceive ourselves as. But it's also really empowering because we recognize by being so interconnected, we can affect change at virtually every level of existence. And I think that is so empowering to know. And when we look at things like the Gaia hypothesis, it might inspire us to want to take better care of the earth in the same way we want to take better care of our bodies, our homes. And, you know, I don't think worshiping a goddess has ever fixed any culture's problems. But I think the idea of embracing the divine feminine as a way of life opens the door to be more conscious of the work that's ahead of us and hopefully gives us the motivation to want to do that work.
I want to mention to our listeners that there actually is a Gaia network at this particular time. Are you familiar with it? The Gaia network? Oh, it's fabulous. It is. It covers all the things we cover on 21st Century Radio and more. And it's extraordinary. Sometime we'll talk more about that. But let me get to how is... No, we got such little time. I've got 12 more questions in front of me. I'll grab this one. Many people use the terms crystal, stone, and minerals, rock, and rock interchangeably. What are the differences between these terms? Say rocks and stones. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, this is a great one. So, you know, a rock is... Well, let's step back and define a crystal first. So a crystal is any usually solid substance with a regular composition and a repeating regular structure. So that could be quartz. It could be the calcium phosphate in your bones. It could be crystalline water or ice. Rocks are naturally occurring inorganic crystals. So they've got that regular structure, regular composition. So those are minerals, rather. Rocks are aggregates of one or more minerals. So you could have something like limestone, which is almost pure calcium carbonate, pure calcite. It's one mineral in composition, but it's lots of little teeny components of it stuck together in space, and that makes it a rock versus just a single mineral. And then we get a word like stone. Stone has a really kind of nebulous definition. Stone kind of refers to anything that is made by geologic activity. It could be a rock, it could be a mineral, it could be not exactly any of those things, like obsidian. Obsidian is not truly a crystal, doesn't have the necessary structure. So that means it can't be a mineral. And since rocks are made of aggregates of one or more minerals, it's not really a rock either, although we call it an igneous rock for the sake of argument. So we might call it a mineraloid. It's something that resembles a mineral in some ways, but not always. And, you know, we can use the word stone, which is less exacting in definition and have all of our bases covered. And then finally, there's the word gem. So a gem is any of the above, plus a few extra things, that we use for ornamental purposes. So you can have something like lapis lazuli, which is a metamorphic rock comprised of many minerals. All of those minerals are crystalline, and we use it as a gemstone. So there are many layers of definition here, but the book makes it nice and simple. There's a great little box in the beginning that defines all these terms very simply for you and gives you examples.
Yep. Very, very useful. We may have enough time to ask you this question. The doctrine of signatures, what is it?
Oh, I'll do my best. The doctrine of signatures was devised by the physician, philosopher, occultist, astronomer, healer, Paracelsus, to describe how for everything in the universe, there is a sort of signature or sign that shows how it corresponds to or relates to other things in the universe. In modern and classical herbalism, we see a lot of evidence of this. So something like liverwort, which resembles a human liver, might be used for treating the liver. Of course, I'm not a doctor and I'm not making medical claims here. I'm just illustrating some examples. But this idea of the doctrine of signatures tells us that all things stemming from the divine mind are somehow interconnected, and there is a secret language of symbolism that we can use to decode that connection. And so with stones, we see that language of symbolism embodied in maybe the historical record. Maybe we see it embodied in its crystal structure or chemical composition. maybe in its formation process. So we can use the doctrine of signatures to relate stones to ailments, conditions, experiences of the human condition, as well as to more mystical things, like connecting them to the alchemical elements or to the planets in some other way. So the doctrine of signatures can be a really interesting and revealing way to explore nature and to look for that sort of mystical web of connection that integrates everything into the unified whole.
Well, this last question, what are the best ways of choosing your stones, is something I could spend a year on, but could you give us a real quickie on that?
Sure. Start with the ones you feel called to. Maybe it's the color, the size, the shape, the way it feels in your hand. But whatever you feel is drawing you in, start there. On the other hand, the ones that really feel like they're sending you in the opposite direction, maybe spend some time with those as well. But there are plenty of practical considerations for how to choose the right ones. You know, if you want to lay stones on the body, spheres are probably not great. If you want to treat someone's third eye chakra, you probably don't want to use a 45-pound piece of lapis lazuli, no matter how much their third eye might need it. So, we just have to make sure that we are honoring the tools, honoring ourselves, honoring the whole experience. So start with some divine guidance, but certainly exercise some good judgment skills.
And I want to thank you for honoring Marcel Vogel, a dear friend of ours from long ago. I was going to send you, do you have an autograph of Marcel Vogel?
I sure don't.
Well, see if I can get one from, I had some of them, at least there were some of his stones. But he was key to my work long, long time ago, and I understanding this, that this was a very important field. Once again, Nicholas, thank you for joining us on 21st Century Radio. We look forward to your joining us again so we can continue learning this very important area.
Thank you. Thank you to everyone tuning in. Thank you, Dr. Bob.
You're extremely welcome, and we'll be seeing you in the future. And Dr. Queen Zahara will be here next week. And you know what's going to happen? Well, she'll tell you.
With stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.